is still a sublime and thrilling chapter in world history. The trial and the execution subsequently of Charles I of England sealed a new covenant of freedom for the British Empire. There was the trial of Aaron Burr, one of the blackest chapters in the annals of our republic. Burr was probably the most extraordinary man of the first half of American history. Except for Thomas Jefferson, Aaron Burr was probably the finest scholar of the Revolution. And yet Burr's arraignment on the charge of high treason was the sad close of a long and lofty life. What we're witnessing in real time today are the many trials of a former president of these United States. And there are, of course, other trials. There was Mary Stuart, the brilliant and beautiful Queen of Scotland. And there are trials every day of those accused of murder and rape and robbery and arson and other crimes. But all of these things I've mentioned are commonplace and tame when compared with the trial and the crucifixion of Jesus the Christ. Jesus, the Galilean peasant from Nazareth. These I've mentioned earlier were trials on earthly issues, trials before earthly courts. The trial of the Nazarene was held before one of the high tribunals of both heaven and earth. Jesus appeared before the Sanhedrin, the justices of which were master spirits of a divinely commissioned race of people. He was tried before the court of the Roman Empire, an empire that controlled the legal and political rights of men throughout the known world at that time. There was a man by the name of Pontius Pilate. Pilate was the Roman governor of Judea, and Jesus appeared before him. In Matthew chapter 27 and verses 21 and 22, we read, "The governor answered and said unto them, Whether of the two will you that I release unto you? And they said, Barabbas. Pilate saith unto them, What shall I do then with Jesus, which is called Christ?" You ever thought about that question? What shall I do with Jesus, who is called Christ? That question is the great question of all of the ages of history. That is a question that at some point every man and woman on the footstool of God must answer. It's a question I have to answer. It's a question you have to answer. What shall I do with Jesus? Think about the life of Jesus Christ. Born in the city of Bethlehem, only 6 miles south of Jerusalem. He was born to parents who were humble, working class, honorable people. There was no room in the inn. So Mary gave birth to Jesus in a stable. And he was cradled in a manger normally reserved for the feeding of livestock. And after he was born, it didn't take long for jealousy to rear its ugly head. Soon after his birth, word came to Mary and to Joseph of a decree that had been issued by Herod the Great, Because Herod had ordered that all male children under the age of 2 be put to death. You see, Herod misunderstood the mission of this babe. Herod misunderstood the mission of why this baby had come into the world. He was afraid that Jesus would someday be king of Israel and take over his throne. So Mary and Joseph were warned of God in a dream, and they fled to the land of Egypt. And there they stayed until Herod died and his son Archelaus took his place. They came out of Egypt then, and they went to Nazareth. And that was done so that what was prophesied in the Scriptures could be fulfilled. Because you see, prophecy had said that Jesus Christ would be lowly, He would be despised, and He would be unattractive. From that point, until Jesus is around the age of 12, the Bible narrative is virtually silent about His life. And then at the age of 12, we find Jesus in the city of Jerusalem. He's sitting in the temple, asking and answering questions of the doctors, the lawyers, and the learned men of that time. And then after that incident, the Scriptures are silent about the life of Jesus for about another 18 years. And then when Jesus is about 30 years old, we find Jesus leaving His home in Galilee. We find Him traveling toward the Judean valleys and the plain around the Jordan River. And He comes to His predecessor, John, and He demands that John baptize Him. And it's after Jesus was baptized in the Jordan River by John that we hear from God. For the very first time, God makes a public announcement about Jesus, and He said, "This is My Son, in whom I'm well pleased." And then Jesus was driven to the wilderness. He fasted 40 days and 40 nights, and He was subjected to the ordeal of temptation. He met the devil there in the wilderness all alone in hand-to-hand combat. Every temptation known to His satanic majesty was hurled at the Son of God. And Jesus came forth from all of those temptations victorious. And then He began His life's work. John tells us He performed His first miracle. John actually refers to the miracles as signs. And John tells us the very first one was at a marriage feast in Cana of Galilee where Jesus turned water into wine. And from that time on, His influence, His prestige, His power, and His prominence began to be seen, to be felt. And it wasn't long till jealousy, enmity, anxiety, all of those emotions took possession of the Jews. You see, those Jews in Palestine were afraid. They were afraid of the growing power of Jesus of Nazareth. Some of those Jews, oh, they were shrewd political characters as well as being strict religious partisans. And they realized something must be done. Something ultimately had to be done to deal with Jesus. They had to deal with this humble Galilean of lowly birth. And so they set about to overcome the influence and the principles that Jesus taught. They were determined. By hook or by crook and by whatever means necessary, they were going to defeat the example of the life of Jesus. So what did they do? They methodically set about to destroy Jesus. And they first began to do this by trying to belittle Him, to ridicule Him, to make fun of Him. They said, "Is this not Mary and Joseph's boy? We've watched him grow up. Well, his brothers are still here with us. He's gotten so uppity. Who does he think he is? He's nothing but just a commoner from over at Nazareth. And can any good thing come out of Nazareth?" That'd be like saying today, well, can any good thing come out of, and I'm not going to say anything past that point. But I can think of a few places. But after all this belittling, and all of this ridicule, and all of the sarcasm they hurled at Jesus, it all absolutely failed. So they tried another tactic. They just tried to meet Him in public discussion and entrap Him. They wanted to engage Jesus, pardon me, in some kind of controversy. They wanted to put Him to an open shame. And then they would suggest to the world that His theories won't stand up. They'd demonstrate to the world that His theories were worthless. So what do we see? We see the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Herodians. They put their heads together on various occasions. They form their plans. They outline their schemes. And they boldly march out with their questions to try and embarrass Jesus. And you know what happened? They failed. And they failed miserably. And the influence of Jesus kept growing and growing and growing. More and more of the common people heard Him, and they heard Him gladly, and they enlisted in His service. And the power of Jesus and the prestige of Jesus, it became greater and greater. And they couldn't belittle Him. And they couldn't entrap Him. So they only had one option left. They had to kill Him. In spite of their best efforts, they could not destroy the doctrine of Jesus. Ridicule and public controversy, neither one were effective. So their only option left open to them was to put Jesus to death. They felt like that if they killed Him, they could be certain His doctrine and His influence would pass from existence. And that brings us to the Passion Week in the life of Jesus. It was the first day of the week. Jesus made His triumphal entry into the city of Jerusalem. It's recorded for us in Matthew 21, Mark 11, and Luke 19. Where Jesus comes riding into the city of Jerusalem, riding on a donkey. The apostles have laid their clothes on the donkey's back. The crowds were lining the streets, and they were waving palm leaves and chanting and hailing Jesus as a conquering hero. It was during this time, during this week, Jesus laid bare the hypocrisy of the whitewashed Pharisees. He denounced them publicly for all of their ungodly deeds. He told them they were like whitened sepulchers that appeared beautiful outward, but inside are filled with dead men's bones and all kinds of uncleanness. And because He denounced those Pharisees, the preparations were made for His death. They actually plotted with one of His own disciples for His death. Because you know what they wanted to do? They wanted to lay their dirty, filthy, griming hands on Jesus and execute Him. That was on Sunday. On Thursday, Jesus came into the city again. He came to eat the Passover with His disciples. That was when He made a great lamentation over Jerusalem. That was when He said, "Oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, thou that killest the prophets and stonest them that are sent to thee, how often I would have gathered thy children together as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wing, and you would not." He went on, as He wept over Jerusalem, He went on to say, "Behold, your house is left unto you desolate." In that statement, Jesus sounded the funeral dirge of Jerusalem, the holy city. And 37 years later, in the destruction of that great city, it came to pass. And finally, we see Judas Iscariot. He goes with that bloodthirsty mob, and they lay hold on Jesus for 30 pieces of silver. For the price of a common slave, Judas had sold Jesus Christ. Jesus saw them coming. And seeing the mob, Jesus scolded them. He actually ridiculed them. He made fun of their cowardice. He said, "You've come out against me as you'd come out against a thief or a robber." You see, Jesus had nothing to hide. He made no effort to run. He offered no resistance. He just submitted. And that's when things started to happen quick. Things started to happen in rapid succession. Jesus is brought before Annas. Annas is the father-in-law of Caiaphas. Annas is the former high priest. His judgment would not be binding, but it would carry extra weight when Jesus is brought before his son-in-law, Caiaphas, who is the current high priest. Annas gives the verdict against Jesus, and then the matter is carried to Caiaphas. And from that point, from Caiaphas is taken to the governor, who happened to be the man we read about at the very beginning, Pontius Pilate. Brought before Pilate, the matter is brushed aside temporarily. Pilate doesn't want to deal with this thing, folks. And he hears that Jesus is from Galilee, so he sends Jesus to Herod. You see, Herod was the ruler of that particular district of Palestine where Galilee was. And Herod happened to be in the city of Jerusalem. So Pilate sends him to Herod. But guess what Herod does? He doesn't want to deal with it either. So Herod refuses to pass judgment and sends the matter back to Pilate. Now Pilate, he's conscious of the grave responsibility that rests upon him at this hour. He knew the rights. He knew the liberties that were granted to the Jews. That the Jews could take men and chastise them. They could persecute them. They could do all manner of evil to them. The exception was, the Jews could not impose capital punishment. But the Jews had already formed a decree, made their charges, and they were determined to get rid of this troublesome Galilean named Jesus. Everything was ready. The preliminaries had been finished, and they brought the prisoner into the presence of Pilate very early Friday morning. I want you to visualize it. I want you to use your sanctified imagination. And I want you to imagine the scene that Friday morning. Because you see, the trial of Jesus was held in open court close by the palace. At one end of the courtyard is an elevated bench. And on that elevated bench is where the governor would sit. I want you to see. He's wearing his Roman toga. His face is smooth. His hair is closely shorn. And with great pomp and dignity, Pilate takes his seat on the bench because he's about to preside over the most remarkable trial in the history of mankind. Standing close by to Pilate's bench are the Pharisees. They're ready. Those Pharisees, they're ready to accuse Jesus. The scribes are there to lend their assistance. Caiaphas is there with the members of the Sanhedrin, and they're ready. All of them ready to make false accusations and to do whatever is necessary to see that Jesus receives condemnation. The crowd, having already been worked into a frenzy, there's that motley crowd assembled in the courtyard, ready to cry out at the right moment when they're instructed to away with this man called the Christ. And standing out in that motley crowd is Jesus, the Son of God, wearing his seamless garment, the only thing he owned, meek, humble. He's ready. He's ready to face the trial. The trial of King Jesus in the presence of Governor Pilate. It's an occasion the likes of which have never been witnessed in all of history. Because you see, during the night, it's early Friday morning, during that Thursday night, Jesus had been rushed through a preliminary trial. So now in the early hours of the morning, he's brought before Pilate. You see, at the feast, it was customary to release one prisoner. And Pilate offers them a choice. Barabbas, a revolutionary, a robber, a hardened criminal. This should have been a no-brainer. Pilate says, "Who would you have that I release unto you?" You see, Pilate has examined Jesus three times. And every time Pilate examined him, the verdict was the same. Over and over, Pilate has said, "I find no fault in this man. None at all." But Pilate saw something in that mob. He saw something about the members of the Sanhedrin. He saw the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and he realized their minds were made up. And logic was not going to prevail. And he called for a basin of water. And he washed his hands. And he announced to everyone there, he said, "I am free from the blood of this just man." What did the Jews say? "Let his blood be on us and our children." We're happy to take that responsibility. Now, this might come as a shock to you. But I think we should treat Pilate with candor and with fairness. I don't think we should condemn Pilate for his rash act without reason. You think of the processes of reason through which the governor's mind had probably passed. In behalf of Jesus, Pilate knew that standing there before him was an innocent man. He knew he had been brought to him because of the envy of the Jews. He also knew that he had the power, as the governor. He had the power to speak the word and let Jesus go. You remember what his wife said? The message his wife sent him concerning Jesus? She said, "Pilate, have nothing to do with the blood of this just man. I've been troubled and suffered many things in a dream because of Jesus." So there's four things Pilate has to consider. There's four things going on in his mind. The Jews brought him to him because of envy. Pilate knew he was innocent. He knew he had the power to speak the word and let Jesus go. And he knew that his wife had told him not to have anything to do with it. So there's these four things going through his mind, favorable to Jesus. But, there's always a but coming, isn't there? There are always two sides to most questions. Pilate had some negative thoughts about Jesus. Pilate was the governor. He was either elected or appointed by the proper authority. But he was a servant of the people. And it was not his will, but the will of the people that must be done. And Pilate probably is thinking, "These folks are determined. These folks are bloodthirsty. They want to kill this man. Their mind is made up. They don't want to be confused by facts. And if I don't yield to them, it'll do no good." Then he further reasoned, he further rationalized. "This man declares himself to be a king. If I release him, there'll be opposition to the king I'm under. And if that happens, I lose my position." So Pilate is vacillating. He reasons back and forth. And ultimately, he chooses to yield to selfish interest rather than follow the dictates of his conscience. When you think about it, that's not much different from politicians today, is it? You see, Pilate is not in a class by himself. Pilate is not the only governor or judge who's ever given a verdict contrary to his best judgment of his best conviction. In politics, our elected officials are always looking to the future. Always. Now don't think for a moment that when they're looking to the future, it usually involves the future of what's best for we the people or best for the country. when those politicians are looking to what is best for the future, it's what's best for them or what's best for their party. And they're not concerned oftentimes with what's right or what's wrong, what's moral or what's immoral, but what's going to get me reelected. And so when folks elect cheap two-bit politicians rather than statesmen, oftentimes it's not a question of what's right or what's wrong or what duty demands or what's best. It's what'll get me reelected. What'll make me more popular. What'll give me more prominence. What'll get me more clicks on the internet. What'll get me more sound bites on the news shows. What'll make me more prominent and more favored by the leaders of my party. Let me say this in passing. No man or woman who reasons after that fashion, no man or woman who goes against their conscience, no man or woman who goes against the convictions of right and wrong is worthy of even the most humble office given by a free and religious people. Now, granted, there are some things that you and I can be neutral about. With reference to many of our governmental problems and the things that are on the morning news, the noon news, the evening news, the late night news, the internet and everywhere else, with reference to many, if not most, of our governmental problems, if I choose to, I can occupy neutral ground. And so can you. You may not be aware of it, but this is an election year. And we will elect a president. But you know something? I don't really have to have an opinion in the presidential election. Now trust me, I have one. I'm not going to tell you what it is, but I have one. But I don't have to have one. And there are some things I can be absolutely neutral about. I have absolutely no problem being neutral about the NBA championship. I really don't care. I also have no problem being neutral about the World Series or the Super Bowl. In fact, if the NFL never plays another game, it won't matter to me one way or the other. All of that said, I do have a very strong preference, and I am in no way neutral about who I want to win the college football national championship this year. I have a definite opinion on that. And if you have to even ask who it is, you don't know me very well. But here's something else, beloved friends. Jesus Christ will not permit me or you to be neutral about Him. In Matthew chapter 12 and verse 30, Jesus said, "He that is not with me is against me." Right here, right now, this morning, I either stand with Jesus Christ or I am an open enemy to that which Jesus bled and died for. The Pharisees, the Sadducees, the Herodians, Rome, they could not get rid of the Son of God. And the question that Pilate asked in our text has been the paramount question of the past 2,000 years. And every man or woman who's ever lived on the top side of God's green earth has to answer that question. You can't pass it up. You can't wipe it out. What shall we do with Jesus who's called Christ? It's a question I have to answer. It's a question you have to answer. And that's the most important question that will ever challenge our attention. It's the most important question you and I will ever be called on to answer. Someday, that question's going to be reversed. Someday when we've passed from the scene of action here and we stand before God in judgment, the question is going to be reversed. Today the question is, what shall I do with Jesus? Someday on the plains of eternal judgment, the question is going to be, what will Jesus do with me? It's His invitation as we stand while we sing.